From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Wallace Stegner has described the remaining wilderness of the American West as the geography of hope. He grew up in the West when the century was young. His father was lured by visions of opportunity and wealth that never materialized. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Wallace Stegner about living and writing in the West. Also, what is consciousness and how can we explain it anatomically? We talk to Israel Rosenfield, who takes on this challenge in his new book. And TV critic David Bianculli looks at how the networks are reacting to their new ratings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Fighting continued today in the former Yugoslav Republic of Bosnia as UN envoy Cyrus Vance appealed for calm. Vance arrived today in Belgrade for talks with the Serbian leaders who dominate what remains of the Yugoslav federal government. The federal army is backing ethnic Serbian militia fighters who oppose Bosnia's independence. Bosnia's population is a mix of Muslims, Croats, and Serbs, and observers say a civil war there would be bloodier than the one in Croatia. Vance told reporters that war in Bosnia would be ruinous for all sides. In Finland today, the United States proposed that the Serb-dominated federal government be suspended from the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe if it doesn't stop fomenting violence in Bosnia. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak says Egypt and other Arab countries will abide by the UN sanctions that have been imposed against Libya. Lori Neff reports from Cairo.
Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak says Arab nations are honoring UN sanctions against Libya. However, he says efforts will continue to resolve the crisis resulting from Tripoli's refusal to surrender to suspects in the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. In remarks to key parliamentarians today, Mubarak also hinted tougher international measures may follow. The editor of Egypt's weekly October magazine, a Mubarak confidant, is predicting the next step would be a Libyan sea blockade that could halt Libyan oil exports responsible for 95% of the country's foreign income. Meantime, aviation officials say two Libyan planes returned back today when they tried to enter Egyptian airspace in defiance of the UN aviation ban. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
It looks as if Los Angeles has selected its next police chief. According to Philadelphia Mayor Ed Rendell, Willie Williams, Philadelphia's police commissioner, has agreed to take the job. More from NPR's Ina Jaffe.
No one in Los Angeles city government has confirmed the selection of Willie Williams as LA's next chief of police. Williams flew to Los Angeles this morning and was met at the airport by the president of the police commission, the oversight panel that selects the police chief. Williams would be the city's first black chief of police and the first chief in 40 years who was not promoted from the ranks of the city's police force. His appointment comes during the final phase of the trial of four white LAPD officers for the beating of black motorist Rodney King. That incident led many community and civil rights groups to call for the ouster of LA's outspoken and controversial police chief, Daryl Gates. Gates has said he will retire by July 1st. In Philadelphia, Willie Williams is known as an advocate of community-based policing and a strong disciplinarian of officers who use excessive force. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained nearly 48 points to close at a record 3,353.76. Advances led declines by nearly 2-1 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. The head of the International Monetary Fund said today that his agency and the World Bank are prepared to begin funneling billions of dollars in aid to Russia and the other former Soviet republics. Michel Camdessou said that the two lending agencies could provide about $45 billion to the republics over the next 4 years. He said the amount of the aid would depend on the republics' progress toward free market economies. Camdessou stressed that his figures were only estimates, but they provided the first glimpse of how much aid Western governments are considering giving to the former Soviet republics. Democratic presidential hopeful Bill Clinton was back on the road again today, testing out his vocal cords on a group of high school students in Southern California. Clinton was asked about the chances of possible third-party candidate, Texas businessman Ross Perot. Kitty Feldy of member station KLON reports.
In his first campaign appearance, since taking time off to rest his voice, Bill Clinton took questions from Monroe High School students on condoms, choosing a running mate, and Ross Perot. Clinton told students a Perot presidential candidacy would certainly be taken seriously by millions of voters.
They think the political system is broken down, but they keep voting for the same things that break the system down. You know, it's like, I don't like this system, but I keep voting for it.
Clinton blamed special interest money and party politics for gridlock in government, but he said Perot's greatest appeal is the fact that he made a lot of money in business and he hasn't been in Washington. Clinton added that neither has he. For National Public Radio, this is Kitty Feldy in Los Angeles.
Former California Governor Jerry Brown was in Pennsylvania today, where he vowed to continue his campaign for the Democratic nomination, even though Bill Clinton has a commanding lead. Brown spent most of the day courting the labor vote in Erie, an industrial city in the northwestern part of the state with a 10% unemployment rate. He was scheduled an appearance at a Philadelphia tax revolt rally this evening. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Wallace Stegner has been called the Dean of Western Writers. He doesn't write about Western myth. He writes about the Western landscape and how it's been changed by development. And he writes about the people who settled the West and the generations that followed. But as one critic has said, Stegner's main region is the human spirit, how one achieves a sense of identity, permanence, a sense of home, in a place where rootlessness and discontinuity dominate. Stegner was born in 1909 and grew up in a family that moved from place to place across the West. Stegner won the Pulitzer Prize for his 1971 novel, Angle of Repose. He holds an important place in American literature as a teacher as well as a writer. For 26 years, he headed the creative writing program at Stanford University. He has a new book of essays called Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs, Living and Writing in the West. Here's a reading from the introduction in which Stegner writes about the true believers and wishful thinkers who settled the West, people like his father.
I know that historical hope, energy, carelessness, and self-deception. I knew it before I could talk. My father practically invented it, though he qualified more as sucker than as booster, and profited accordingly. He was a boomer from the age of 14, always on the lookout for the big chance, the ground floor, the inside track. As a youth, he tried the Wisconsin and Minnesota woods, but found only the migratory wage slavery that's always been one payoff of the American dream. He tried professional baseball, but wasn't quite good enough. In the 1890s, he floated out to North Dakota on the tail end of the land rush, but found himself in the midst of a 10-year drought and ended up speculating in wheat futures and running a blind pig. If you believe that the world owes you not merely a living but a bonanza, then restrictive laws are only an irritation and a challenge. When it became clear that Dakota's promises were indistinguishable from Siberian exile, my father dragged us out the migration route to the Northwest. His goal then was Alaska, but again he was late. The Klondike rush was long over. The survivors had straggled back. For a while, he ran a lunchroom in the Washington woods where the Seattle suburb of Redmond now is. The loggers cut down the trees and left the lunchroom among the stumps. By 1914, we were up in Saskatchewan, part of another land rush, where for a change we would be in on the ground floor and make a killing growing wheat to feed Europe's armies.
Do you think of your father's personality as being typical of a certain kind of restless loser who populated the West?
Not always a loser. You know, he was characteristic, I think, but sometimes they were losers and sometimes they were big winners. He was a product of his times, and though I used to resent him a great deal, I find that now I feel rather sorry for him. I think he was made by his times. At the end of a frontier, when there was no longer the kind of frontier opportunity that for so long had been part of the American consciousness. And he tried a lot of things and none of them worked, or very few of them worked.
So did you really resent it when you were young and every time he had a new scheme, you had a move?
Well, he was not that so much as he was a frustrated man, and sometimes he took out his frustration on whatever was handy. But that too, I can understand. I'm sometimes frustrated, and I take it out on some people, too.
You write, my father wanted to make a killing and end up on Easy Street. I wanted to hunt up and rejoin the civilization I had been deprived of. Where did you go looking for it?
Oh, school and the public libraries, primarily. There was a big division between my home life, because Neither of my parents was educated even through high school, even to high school. So that there was no background of cultivation, reading, anything else. Though my mother was a reader, she didn't know what to read. She had no guide. She would have had a good deal of cultural capacity, you know, if she'd had any guidance, but she didn't. And I got mine from school and from the public libraries, where I took out 7 books a week and read most of them.
Writer Wallace Stegner is my guest. Had you grown up on the myths and the folklore and the cliches of the West, you know, the cowboy stories?
Oh, sure. I grew up not only on the myth, but among cowboys. When we moved to Canada, we were in the tail end of a period of cattle raising, which had been pretty well wiped out in 1906 and 7 by a terrible winter. But in the protected edge of the hills where we lived, there were still cattle ranches, and lots of cowpunchers still working on ranches, hired men on horseback. They weren't the romantic figures that the myth made of them. They were also, as a class, I should say, very macho, somewhat callous, somewhat brutal. Nice guys in a way, but brutal. And they also had a code of hating the crybaby, hating anything unlike themselves, despising anything womanish or oversensitive.
There might have been no room there for somebody who spent a lot of time reading like you.
Well, I don't know. I got into the cowboy business quite a lot as a boy, but by the time I moved out of it, I was a little tired of it because I had some little physical defects. My hands were always cold, for one thing, and you can't live in Saskatchewan with cold hands and like it. things like that. So that I resented sometimes the harshness of the code, though I was always trying to live up to it.
But what about reading? Where did that fit in? I mean, for the kind of a brutal macho code that you're describing, that doesn't seem to fit with the boy.
Well, there wasn't any reading up there.
Yeah.
Up in Canada, you know, there was no public library. Every family there may have had 3 books. We traded them all over town. Sometimes they never came back. My father, at one point in his life, got excited about, I guess he'd seen a Shakespeare play, so he bought a set of Shakespeare from a traveling salesman. We had that. Hmm. We had a few things like that. Mostly what we read was magazines, I suppose, and later when we got onto them, Tarzan stories and things like that.
I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, but when I was young, my dreams were about being a cowgirl. I mean, I would literally dream,
yep,
you know, about riding a horse and wearing a leather outfit and, you know, the whole Western myth. I grew up watching Westerns and the movies and on TV, and I just loved them.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, like, growing up in the West and knowing actual cowboys, what effect those kinds of movies and novels had on you? You grew up before television.
Yeah, sure. I grew up a long time before television, and I was never actually very, very taken by the Western myth because I knew how far it was from the actual facts. A cowboy's life is spent punching post holes and branding and castrating and things like that, and very hard work and very low pay, and his celebrated liberty is generally the liberty to quit his bad job and go get another one just as bad. In terms of his migratoriness, his placelessness, his uprootedness, he was very often as bad off as a contemporary crop worker. And he's not a romantic figure in life, though very often real cowboys imitate their mythical counterparts and try to think themselves into that role. So I'm a little anti-cowboy. You've got the wrong coon here to to talk to.
You're just joining us. My guest is writer Wallace Stegner, and he has a new collection called Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs, Living and Writing in the West. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Rutter Wallace Degner is my guest. I'm interested in hearing how you've seen the West change as a literary place. You once wrote, there are thousands more federal employees in the West than there are cowboys. There may be more writers. At what point in your life did the West start to become a place that was considered to be a place that had writers living there, writing about the region with a distinctive voice, as publishers from the region publishing those distinctive voices?
That came pretty late in my life. I had graduated from college, I think, at the age of 20 or 21, before I ever saw a writer. It seemed to me that writers were people who lived a long time ago and a long way off, and it never occurred to me that I could be one or should be one, even though I liked to write, and it was encouraged a little bit in school. I suppose it never occurred to me really to take seriously the notion of being a writer until I went away to graduate school in Iowa, and there I was offered the chance to write some stories for an MA thesis and jumped at the chance. And, you know, a couple of those were published in little magazines or so, and that's the extent of that. And that was the middle of the Depression, and I couldn't stay on. There was no job outside, so I stayed on in school, but I couldn't stay on just to be a writer, so I took a PhD in American literature. And that pretty well killed the writing impulse for several years. It takes a long time to get over that. But about 2 years after that, I was back teaching in Salt Lake, and I sat down one afternoon and wrote a story in about 3 hours about Saskatchewan. And somebody, I guess the Virginia Quarterly, bought it, and then I was hooked. But that was pure accident. In Iowa, I had met a few writers, and I had certainly got a notion that writing was something that happened among contemporary living people. But it still hadn't jarred my consciousness that I could pretend to compete in that area.
So you said that the West became a place identified with writers, or writers identified with the West. Later in your life, when did you really feel that starting to happen?
Well, not for quite a while. I lived in Cambridge, Mass. For a while and taught at Harvard, and I met a lot of writers, some of whom were from the West, and I certainly had my mind opened up to possibilities. I guess I myself considered at that point that Western writing was some inferior, second-rate genre. I didn't have very many pretensions as a writer myself, though I had written a couple of novels. And when I wrote The Big Rock Candy Mountain, which was about the West, that more or less typecast me. By the time I had come out to Stanford, which was right at the end of World War II, there obviously was much more going on, and the GI students who came to Stanford showed up with a lot of talent and an enormous backed-up flood of energy and enthusiasm. That was the time when I really began to get enthusiastic about the possibilities in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And when we founded the writing program at Stanford, which is still going.
Yeah, well, I think you headed that creative writing program at Stanford for about 26 years. So, I mean, it's probably fair to say that you had a lot to do with nurturing a lot of the writers
from the West. I hope I had some,
West.
Yeah. I hope I had some effect. I'm sure I had some little effect. Not necessarily by teaching, but by example, because by then I was pretty deep in writing about the West, both as history and as fiction.
Mm-hmm.
I was writing only, you know, about what I knew and what I liked to write about, and there was nothing very deliberate about that. It just turned out that way.
You know, writing requires such patience and reworking. And it seems like as a writer, you'd have to have the opposite kind of temperament that your father had. Your father always looking for a bonanza to pan out and moving to the next place. How do you feel you got the temperament necessary to write, given the background that you grew up in?
Well, partly because I was pretty much in constant rebellion against my father, so anything he did, I would do the opposite. But also, I suppose, getting a Ph.D. teaches you patience. Believe me, you sit a long time just looking at books until the type begins to run and blur, and sitting at looking at blank walls and listening to blank voices. Patience is something learned to... When you have a book to write, particularly a long book, a novel, you have to go there 7 days a week, 4 hours a day, sit in that chair, and one of the earliest things you have to learn is to keep your seat in that chair, or don't vacate it very long. Just get up and walk around and come back and sit down. That's something that I think the profession itself teaches you. If you're going to stay in it, you have to learn it.
Mm-hmm. You taught at Stanford for about 26 years, the creative writing program. How do you think your teaching was different when you retired from what it was when you started?
It was tireder. There are some occasions when you're teaching a writing class, which has to be Socratic. You know, you can't tell them how to do it. You have to sort of help them find how to do it, which sometimes after a 2-hour seminar would leave me feeling as if I'd carried the whole class up 4 flights of stairs on my back. That gets wearing. And sometimes, of course, the class doesn't meld. It just doesn't blend. It never comes together. I don't know quite what magic and chemistry is involved there, but 6 out of 7 or 8 times, it would be wonderful, a really exhilarating kind of class to teach. And once, maybe 2 or 3 times during my 26 years, it was just a load.
Do you feel that you did some of your students a favor by telling them not to write?
I hardly ever had the nerve to tell somebody not to write. You're dealing with such sensibilities that any harsh criticism of something so intimate as a piece of fiction that somebody is determined to write is very hard on the soul of the person who has to receive that criticism. Sometimes it would save them a lot of trouble to be told, no, I don't think you have a speck of talent. You have sometimes you're intelligent, straight A-plus students and so on, you still can't do it. The gift is not there. And without the gift, there's nothing much that can be learned. You can't teach people much. I have discouraged some writing young writers. I think they needed discouraging. But they were not the kind who were passionately devoted to their art. They were, essentially, they liked the idea of being writers, but they really didn't have that drive to write. So I could discourage them without killing them off. But some writers I would be very, very careful not to discourage entirely.
Mm-hmm.
Let them find out for themselves over a period, long, painful period of apprenticeship that didn't produce anything. That's the only way it would be psychically sound, I think, to tell them, let them tell themselves.
You live part of the year in Vermont, which is way out east. How did somebody so associated with the West as yourself end up living part of the year in the East?
Well, actually, I've lived in Vermont, had a house in Vermont longer than anywhere else in my life. We went there when I was teaching at the University of Wisconsin to visit some friends, and before we left, we reached down into our very thin depression period purse and bought us an old farm, a real back farm, and put a few $100 into fixing it up and used it for a few summers. All the time we were at Harvard, we used it. And once we got out to Stanford, we missed a couple of years, and then we began going back because we like it. In many ways, Vermont reminds me of the West before the West began to be clear-cut and despoiled. because Vermont heals. You can clear cut a Vermont wood, and for a while it'll just come up to Christmas trees and brush and fireweed and so on. But you turn your back for a few years and it's a young forest, and you turn your back for 15 years and you've got a woods again. That's not true in the West. The West doesn't heal in the same way. So I like Vermont because it is, though it's greener than any country I was brought up in, it is healthy. It smells the right way.
You wrote a few years ago, "Except when I have to tie my shoelaces, I don't feel 80 years old. But if I don't feel decrepit, neither do I feel wise or confident." Does that still describe how you feel?
Yeah, I'm afraid it does, because, partly I think we are a little less optimistic as the effects of age begin to catch up with us. But also, perhaps this is an absolutely cultural, predictable response. Everything looks better from the time we were young. Everything in the past looks better than the present. But I can't see much to cheer about in the present. It seems to me politics are dirtier. In terms of the West, the spoliation of the air, water, and soil, and grass and trees is worse. We're getting closer and closer to using up what we were given, and there's nothing being replaced.
You wrote that with age you neither feel wise nor confident. Have you been waiting for wisdom, and have you always believed that wisdom comes with age and you can count on that?
There was a time when I thought I was wise, but I don't think so anymore. I think we are all more confident of ourselves in our youth, because confidence goes with physical competence and energy and the rest of it. I am not that confident anymore, and I'm not so sure that I was ever wise, you know. The things that happen, you get somehow bent by circumstances. And I used to be a real prig about my father. I really hated him, you know, for the things that he had done and for his general attitude. The longer I go, the more I feel sorry for him. And that's almost a sadder business than disliking him.
We know you wrote that he died penniless and friendless in a flea bag hotel. Were you his friend when he died?
We were still in correspondence, yeah. I was trying to help him a little. I couldn't very much because that was in the Depression still. But he gambled on too many gold mines and so on. And he was, the word I used was sucker, which is unkind, but that's really what he was. He believed in these things that would happen, these good things that would happen. It never occurred to him that if they were going to happen, somebody much better healed and better informed than he would already have taken advantage of him.
Writer Wallace Stegner. His new book of essays is called Where the Bluebird Sings to the Lemonade Springs, a new edition of his 1971 Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Angle of Repose has just been published by Penguin. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, memory and consciousness, why we have both, and why computers have memory and no consciousness. We talk with Dr. Israel Rosenfield. His new book, The Strange, Familiar, and Forgotten, looks for an anatomical understanding of consciousness. It challenges the classical approach to neurology. Also, TV critic David Bianculli tells us how the networks are reacting to their new ratings. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Moscow, the Congress of People's Deputies has ended Russia's current political crisis by voting in favor of President Boris Yeltsin's program of economic reforms. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
It took long hours of negotiation and lots of shouting and fighting on the floor of the Congress, but finally the majority of members of the Congress of People's Deputies has done what President Yeltsin wanted them to do. Declare their support for reform and let Yeltsin's cabinet carry it out. The vote today averts a governmental crisis and the possibility that Yeltsin's cabinet might resign. It also appears to safeguard this particular government until at least December, as well as Yeltsin's emergency power to rule by decree. Yeltsin's cabinet had threatened to resign if the Congress did not rescind a series of budget-busting policies adopted a few days ago. By the vote today, the Congress has not repealed those policies, but simply given Yeltsin's government discretion in carrying them out. That was enough for Yeltsin's team to declare today's vote a victory. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
UN sanctions against Libya are now in effect as Western nations try to get Tripoli to hand over suspects in the bombing of two Western airliners. Libya has indicated that it may expel diplomats of nations supporting these sanctions, which bar air travel and arms sales. Despite grounding of flights to and from Libya, land and sea links continue, including ferry service to the island of Malta. Sanctions do not include a boycott of Libya's oil sales, which account for 90% of the nation's earnings. UN Special Envoy Cyrus Vance is now in Belgrade and says that the UN will not widen its peacekeeping operations in Croatia to include Bosnia. Pierre Vickery reports that although the headquarters of the UN peacekeeping mission is located in Sarajevo, UN troops based there have no mandate to intervene in the fighting.
Cyrus Vance told a press conference in the Serbian capital Belgrade that the United Nations will not deploy peacekeeping troops in the newly independent Republic of Bosnia-Herzegovina, despite its concern about the fighting there. He said there were insufficient funds either to extend the UN mandate from neighboring Croatia or to increase the number of international troops deployed in the Balkans to keep the peace. Cyrus Vance held talks with senior Serbian political and military leaders and is expected to travel to the Bosnian capital Sarajevo tomorrow. Meanwhile, heavy fighting is reported to be continuing in western Herzegovina as Serbian units of the former Federal Army maintain their two-week military offensive in the mainly Croatian region. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 48 points to close at 3,353.76, a record. There was very heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Chicago, power came back to parts of the downtown area today after flooding this week that caused millions of dollars in damages. At the Board of Trade, operations were still curtailed as workers continued to pump water from the building's basement. Other crews tried to stop the flow of water in a hole in an aging freight tunnel system. There was heavy rain this morning that caused problems, but then the sun arrived. All street parking has been banned until further notice in much of the city's downtown area. So far, damage is estimated in the millions of dollars. A study in today's New England Journal of Medicine shows that people infected with the AIDS virus tend to live longer if they take the drug AZT. NPR's Richard Harris has that story.
Since 1987, scientists have known that AZT keeps the AIDS virus in check, but it's been difficult to tell just how much benefit people get from taking it. Studies do show that the drug prolongs the lives of people who are already sick with AIDS. Also, people who are HIV positive and take AZT don't develop AIDS as quickly. But it's been controversial whether the drug actually prolongs their lives. Now, a large study from Johns Hopkins University shows that people who are infected with the AIDS virus do, in fact, live longer if they take AZT. This study doesn't completely settle the issue, but it is the strongest support yet for doctors who prescribe AZT for their infected patients before they get sick with AIDS. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
According to an energy trade group, the U.S. upped its dependence on foreign oil last month by nearly 9%, with U.S. oil production at its lowest level in 6 years. According to the American Petroleum Institute, imports were up 8.7% in March compared to a year ago at the same time to 7.1 million barrels a day. At the same time, crude oil production dropped 2.4%. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. As Israel Rosenfield writes, one of the most interesting questions we can ask about ourselves is what is the nature and structure of our consciousness? Although we can't yet answer that question with any great precision, the more we learn about the complex structure of consciousness, the more we are forced to abandon many ideas about memory and the nature of thought and action. Rosenfield is the author of the new book, The Strange, Familiar, and Forgotten: An Anatomy of Consciousness. He also wrote an earlier book called The Invention of Memory. In the introduction, neurologist Oliver Sacks described Rosenfield as having a mind of remarkable range, with a nose for the most important new theories and unifications in biological science and neuroscience. Rosenfield holds an MD as well as a PhD in intellectual history, and he's a professor at the City University of New York. Consciousness is a difficult subject to discuss. I know I have it, but I don't think I could define it, so I asked Dr. Rosenfield to take a stab at it.
Well, I think without really answering that question directly, I think different people define consciousness in different ways. But in terms of my main concern, I think one of the main characteristics of consciousness is subjectivity. And so if you want to talk about consciousness, one of the things you want to explain or try to understand is the subjectivity that we associate with consciousness. And second of all, I think the other aspect of consciousness, which I'm concerned with specifically, and I think there's a long tradition to talk about that aspect as well, and that is the idea that consciousness is a kind of continuity. That is, when we are conscious, we always feel somehow it's related to the instant before, it's related to the way we were a year ago, it's related to the way we were 20 years ago, and so on. So I think the two main aspects that concern me, and I think that would concern anybody who's talking about consciousness, are first of all the problem of subjectivity, and second of all the problem of continuity, that is that the idea that there's a sort of flow and we're interconnected, as it were, with all the different instants, all the different moments throughout our lives. I mean, we sense that it's always us, the same person. So basically the idea of flow and the idea of subjectivity are interrelated as well.
Oliver Sacks, the well-known neurologist who's also the author of the bestseller The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, has a quote on the back of your book praising the book and saying about you, Israel Rosenfield is a powerful and original thinker who believes that the classical approach to neurology, for all its great achievements, is now bankrupt and that it's impossible to understand states of neurological illness or health without reference to the person's ever-changing body image, consciousness, being. What exactly is it about classical neurology that you're challenging? What's the approach that you're challenging?
I think there are, in toto, one could say, the main issue is that it has ignored the whole question of consciousness. I think related to that is that one has inherited, and I think it's in a way goes back before classical neurology, an idea about memory which is false. And that is that memory is simply information stored in the brain. And I think what that fails to capture is the idea that memory has something dynamic about it, and that when we recall something or when we recognize something, it's clearly dependent on dynamic images. And what we want to try to explain now is where that dynamic, the dynamic imaging comes from, and why it is that you could not simply describe memory as stored information. For example, a computer could never recognize, if you stored an image, a photograph of, let's say, X in the computer, it would really have to see that photograph again in order to recognize that particular person. Whereas any human being or any animal can recognize people or whatever from various different positions and with all kinds of changes in clothing, in hairdo, and so on. And consequently, what that means is there's something very different about the nature of memory than what we've inherited. And I think the classical view has, which continues to this day, is basically memory is stored images, and we have to change that.
So neurology didn't take memory into account? Is that what you're saying?
No, the notion of memory was a notion of stored information that was static, much like memory in a computer. And what I'm saying is that, in fact, human and animal recognition could not be based on a static image. Because if it were just comparing what I'm seeing to that static image, I would never recognize somebody who's changed their clothing or, you know, somebody who's grown a beard or whatever. That is, that as they age, I can always recognize them. I might have seen somebody for 2 years, and I can still recognize them 2 years later. Why? A computer couldn't do that. So clearly the nature of memory is quite different from simply storing information, you see. And the other thing about memory is that unlike a computer memory, where one could say I can transfer the memory from one computer to another, there's no way in which you can transfer my memories from one brain to another.
It would be interesting if you could, wouldn't it?
It would be interesting if you could, and I think a lot of sci-fi is built on that idea,
but
I think one of the points about memory is that it's subjective. It depends. My memory depends upon me. I mean, my way of seeing the world is my way of seeing the world. If I give you that same information, you're going to see the world differently.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the brain and consciousness, and my guest is Israel Rosenfield, who's the author of the new book, The Strange, Familiar, and Forgotten, An Anatomy of Consciousness. We'll talk more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Israel Rosenfield is my guest, author of the new book, The Strange, Familiar, and Forgotten, An Anatomy of Consciousness. Now that we have CAT scans and magnetic resonance imaging, we can actually, the doctors, the scientists, can actually see the brain in ways that it had never been seen before and kind of see it functioning in a way that's never been seen before. What kind of breakthroughs do you think that's leading to, or do you believe that that's leading us in false directions as well?
Well, I think in a way it's falsifying the story, because basically what we're seeing was already described in the 19th century. All we're doing is seeing it in living individuals, whereas in the 19th century one had to wait until the person died and do an autopsy. And one is deluding oneself that one is actually watching a living brain. I mean, it's very spectacular to see these images. But is one, in fact, really seeing the brain functioning? I mean, clearly, there are enormous activities going on. That is, there are enormous interchanges from one part of the brain to another. And all of this is on a microscopic level, that you're not seeing it all in the scanner. So in a sense, one is really not watching the brain, a live brain, function. And there is nothing new that has come out of scanner studies. There's nothing that's been said that has not already been said in the 19th century. I mean, to say that that particular area of the brain has this particular function is certainly not a new idea. The question is, clearly that area of the brain, if I isolated it and put it in a jar, would not have that particular function. It clearly depends on the rest of the brain, and the question is how. How does it create that particular kind of function? I mean, if we took the speech areas, for example, in the brain that were discovered by Broca and Wernicke, cut them out and put them in a jar, we could never make, even if we hooked it up to a vocal apparatus, that vocal apparatus speak. So what do you mean by having a specific function? I mean, clearly those speech areas depend on the rest of the brain. And what you're seeing on the scanner is, well, the speech area lights up because it's more active at that point. Well, there are other parts that are also active, and we're deluding ourselves to think that they're not doing anything at that particular point. We don't know what they're doing.
So are you saying that to really understand consciousness, you have to look not only at the brain, but at the body that is attached to the brain?
That's right. And I think that's what... In fact, when I talk about the bankruptcy of neurology, I think when you look at some of these cases, one of the things that I think was overlooked was the whole question of the body image and the way in which the brain, in fact, uses a body image when we're trying to recall and when we're trying to see the world around us.
What do you mean by body image?
What I mean by body image is that, well, to give you an example of what I would mean, if I asked you, let's say, to write the letter A, clearly every time you write it differently, but there must be an image, as it were, or some sort of abstraction of the letter A in your brain that permits you to write it with different parts of your body, that permits you actually to recognize the letter A, even though they're never exactly the same, or in fact they're quite different, and also permits you to draw letters that are very different and yet are always the same letter. Well, by the same token, there must be a kind of, quote, let's say, image, an unconscious image in the brain, just like there's an, quote, image that would allow me to draw the letter A, there must be an image of my body. Otherwise, it's what's coordinating all the movement of my body. Otherwise, I'd fall over if it's not coordinated. And I'm calling that the body image that's doing the coordination, that's clearly very dynamic because clearly my body's moving and changing all the time. And what I'm saying is that dynamic unconscious image is playing a very important role in our ability to see and to hear and touch the world. I mean, clearly it's orienting the stimuli, as it were, but it's doing much more than that. And it's also essential to the whole process of memory.
Now, how does body image connect with consciousness? Because you talk about the connection in your book.
Well, what I'm arguing is that if you isolated the brain, as you put it in a test tube, without any body attached to it, it could never become conscious. That is, it's the body is part of, if you want, the structure of the brain. And if you want an example of that, if you take extrasensory deprivation experiments in which you try to deny the body of all sensation, you can't do that completely, but you can try to isolate it as much as possible. What's interesting about those cases is when they become almost anesthetized, as it were, that is, when they become isolated, people begin to lose the ability to perceive, and they begin to lose the ability to remember. They become actually crazy. In fact, it's a very dangerous experiment. So when you have extrasensory deprivation, what you're basically doing is eliminating the body, that is, the body image for the brain, and at the same time, what's curious is you're eliminating all ability to see the world around you and to remember. And that, in fact, very nicely shows that there's clearly some kind of connection from the point of view of the brain between the body image, that is, its own body, and memory and perceiving.
Right? So if you think that using scanners to analyze the brain is leading us down dead ends...
Well, I'm not against it. I mean, I think one has to be careful with
right.
what it means.
Uh-huh. So what would you think is a more fruitful approach to trying to understand consciousness?
I don't think there. I think one has to be careful. I don't think there is a right way to go about this, and I think scanners are as important as anything else. We don't know. I think one has to accumulate as much, that is, try as many different ways to understand it as possible, and accept as many different odd ideas as possible about consciousness, and little by little, maybe we'll come to some better understanding of what it's all about. I don't think there's one right way to go about this. Scientific discoveries have never been that way. And it's very often the oddball idea that has led somewhere, or that is, it may even be wrong in itself, but it somehow led to an idea which was very fruitful. And sometimes it's the oddball idea that's in fact in itself very fruitful. So one can't predict.
I'm wondering, you're looking for a kind of biological, anatomical understanding of consciousness. But consciousness seems to me to be as much a philosophical or an almost spiritual concept as it is an anatomical one. Do you think that we'll ever find an anatomical understanding of consciousness?
Well, I don't know, and perhaps not, but I think what I'm trying to say is that what you're calling the spiritual or psychological notions of consciousness are as relevant to our discussions of whatever the physical basis of consciousness is, as we have to include that in our discussion. Otherwise, we're falsifying the nature of what the brain's all about. That's basically what I'm arguing. I mean, in a sense, I'm arguing something very similar to what you're arguing, and that is that it's not an irrelevant issue, this whole question of consciousness. You can't talk about our function without also talking about the whole question, what you're calling the spiritual side. Where's it coming from? You know, it's certainly playing a role in terms of brain function in general. And why? And we have to begin to explain that.
What most mystifies you about your own consciousness? You know, the impossible thing, one of the impossible things about studying consciousness is that you can only understand it through your own. So the dilemma of studying the brain, in a way, you can only learn as much as your own brain allows you to figure out. But are there things that just particularly mystify you?
About consciousness?
Yeah, about thinking yourself, you know, about your own consciousness.
Well, what it is, I mean, to be perfectly honest, yes, I'm mystified by what it is. Where does it come from? I don't, you know, I don't have any idea of the answer. I mean, what is odd is clearly that I believe that it has a material base, and yet I can't imagine how it sort of arises and why it disappears when one dies, which is what I also would believe. As, you know, how this thing, this enormous sense of subjectivity that I have of being alive can exist and then suddenly not exist anymore. I find it very troubling, to say the least, like most people. I have no idea really where it comes from. And yet, on the other hand, I can't believe it has any sort of external origin. I mean, I think it comes from some sort of bodily processes, and exactly how, I don't know.
Now, you were trained as a mathematician, physician, philosopher, and historian of ideas, not a neurologist. How did you get interested in studying the brain and looking for consciousness?
How did I get interested in studying the brain? Actually, I'm not sure I have an answer to that question. I mean, I've been writing about the brain for some 20 years now, so I think it's probably one of the central questions of any kind of philosophical or intellectual endeavor in our own day. That is, it's the big scientific question at the moment. That is, what's the brain all about? It's so-called the last frontier to try to explain it. And so I think, like everybody else, I mean, it's something that's very stimulating, and therefore one accepts the challenge, basically.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.
Israel Rosenfield is the author of The Strange, Familiar, and Forgotten, An Anatomy of Consciousness, published by Knopf. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
News from the United Nations about sanctions and Libya. Also news from Chicago about the cleanup following the flood there. We'll also hear from workers returning to their jobs in Peoria, Illinois at Caterpillar now that the United Auto Workers strike has ended, workers back on the job. And we'll be talking with two people who've been following the Caterpillar strike very closely, who have very different views about what this means for the future of pattern bargaining between labor and management in this country. And Alice Furlow will report on French reaction to the opening of Euro Disney, including some chagrin at just how popular this new Disneyland near Paris is.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The final rating results for the 1991-92 TV season were released this week, and TV critic David Bianculli says he's interested not only in the overall standings and in how some specific new shows did in the ratings, but in how the networks reacted to the news.
For the 30-week TV season that ended last Sunday, CBS went from third place to first, NBC slipped from first to second, and ABC fell from second to third. Fox, of course, remained in fourth place, slightly ahead of Nintendo. The rating itself refers to the number of households watching a particular show or network. Each ratings point equals 921,000 households. So that means CBS's 60 Minutes, the most popular series of the season, was seen each week in some 20 million homes. But networks, like politicians, have their own spin doctors and their own ways of interpreting these results. ABC, for example, doesn't count just households, but the number of people in those households, which it claims gives Roseanne top honors for the year. More kids watch Roseanne than 60 Minutes, so presto, Roseanne has a bigger overall audience. NBC says no, it's demographics that counts, because advertisers are most interested in reaching viewers between the ages of 18 to 49. And since NBC doesn't even do well there, NBC announced this week that it was no longer accepting the traditional definition of the 30-week TV season. From now on, NBC is playing the game all year long, 52 weeks a year, and keeping score that way, too. And both NBC and ABC complained that CBS had the Olympics, the World Series, and the Super Bowl. But CBS says it would have won without them. CBS says it used to call for a 52-week season, too, back when it was in third place. But now the executives say they like things just fine as they are. And though Fox is way behind the other three, its ratings went up 25%, more than twice the percentage gain of CBS. But nobody here is pointing out that the 0.1% that puts NBC above ABC is within the Nielsen system's margin of error, which means it could just as easily be the other way around. Or that CBS won the season this year with a lower rating than the losing network had 5 years ago. Instead, the network spin doctors insist that since cable TV is now available to 93% of all TV households, cable can't erode much more of the broadcast network's audience. That's not just optimistic, that's stupid. Just because cable is available to all those homes, that doesn't mean all those people are subscribers. And since some cable series are better and bolder than most network series this year, the defections are bound to continue. HBO all by itself offers viewers Dream On, Sessions, and Tales from the Crypt, three great reasons to sign up and tune in. But what did the broadcast networks give us this season? Of the new shows, the only really good ones were NBC's I'll Fly Away, CBS's Brooklyn Bridge, and ABC's Civil Wars and the late-arriving Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. And the only new top 20 hits, ABC's Home Improvement and Room for Two, are shows that benefited greatly from their popular lead-ins, Full House and Roseanne, respectively. There were too many reality shows like Eyewitness Video last season, and there was too little imagination. Unless the networks take more risks and draw more viewers who have all but given up on commercial TV, winning the ratings race won't mean much. The way things are going, with most of the networks losing ground, the winner will be able to claim victory merely by standing still. And finally, the lowest-ranked series of the season, ranked 129th out of 129 shows, was Fox's Get a Life. It's a message TV programmers should take to heart.
And in the place where you live,
now they snow.
Think about direction, wonder why you have it now.
Stand
in the place where you were,
now face west.
Think about the place where you live, wonder why you haven't before. If you are confused, check with the sun. Carry a compass to help you along. Your feet are going.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. We're listening to R.E.M. with the theme music from the Fox series Get a Life. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Joan Tuohy and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
British writer and director Dennis Potter has made some of the most innovative television seen on either side of the Atlantic. On the next Fresh Air, we talk to the creator of Pennies from Heaven and The Singing Detective. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.